The surface was not as smooth as it had appeared at a distance. There were deep cracks, some lateral, others running vertically from the foot to the summit, and the granite was flaking away in the onion peel effect caused by heat expansion and contraction. This left small, sharp-edged steps, which would give footholds and make it possible for a man to reach the top, though it would be an exposed and potentially dangerous climb. On the summit, a cluster of perfectly round boulders, each the size of a large dwelling house, formed a symmetrical crown. The whole was one of those natural compositions so artful and contrived that it seemed to have been conceived and executed by human engineers. Santein was strongly reminded of the dolmens which he had visited as a child in France, or one of those ancient Mayan temples in the South American jungles which he had seen illustrated. Blaine had left her side and led his mount towards the foot of the granite cliff, and something on the crest of the kopje caught Santein's eye. It was a flicker of movement in the shadow beneath one of the crowning boulders on the summit, and she shouted a warning. "Blaine, be careful! On the top!" He was standing at his horse's head with the reins over his shoulder, staring upwards. But before he could respond to her warning, there was a thud as though a sack of wheat had been dropped on a stone floor. Santein did not recognize the sound as a high-velocity bullet striking living flesh, until Blaine's horse staggered, its front legs collapsed, and it dropped heavily, dragging Blaine with it. Santein was stunned until she heard the whiplash crack of the Mauser from the summit of the kopje, and she realized that the bullet had reached them before the sound. All around her, the troopers were shouting and wrestling with their panicking horses, and Santein spun and vaulted for the saddle of her own mount. With one hand on the pommel and without touching the stirrup iron, she was up, dragging the horse's head around. "Blaine, I'm coming!" she screamed. He had scrambled to his feet beside the carcass of his horse, and she rode for him. "Grab my stirrup!" she called. And the Mausers up on the hill were cracking bullets amongst them. She saw Sergeant Hansmeyer's horse shot dead beneath him, and he was pitched headlong from the saddle. Blaine ran to meet her and seized her dangling stirrup. She turned the horse and heeled him into a full gallop, pumping the reins, heading back for the sparse cover of the Mopane, 200 yards behind them. Blaine was swinging on the stirrup leather, his feet skimming the ground, making giant strides as he kept level with her. "Are you all right?" she yelled. "Keep going!" His voice strained at the effort, and she looked back under her arm. The gunfire still crackled and snapped around them. One of the troopers turned back to help Sergeant Hansmeyer, but as he reached him, a bullet hit his horse in the head, and it crashed over and flung the trooper sprawling to earth. "They are picking off the horses!" Santein cried, and she realized that hers was the only animal still unscathed. All the others were down, killed with a single shot in the head for each of them. It was superb marksmanship, for the men on the summit were firing downhill at a range of 150 paces or more. Ahead of her, Santein saw a shallow ravine that she had not noticed before. There was a tangle of fallen, dead Mopane branches upon the nearest bank, a natural palisade, and she rode for it, forcing her winded horse down the bank in a scrambling heap, and then immediately springing down and seizing his head to control him. Blaine had been dragged off his feet and had rolled down the bank, but he pulled himself up. "I walked into that ambush like a greenhorn," he snarled, angry at himself. "Too bloody tired to think straight." He jerked the rifle out of the scabbard on Santein's saddle and climbed quickly to the lip of the bank. Ahead of him, the dead horses lay below the steep, smooth slope of the kopje, and Sergeant Hansmeyer and his troopers were dodging and jinking as they sprinted back for the cover of the ravine. Mauser fire crackled, kicking up spouts of yellow dust about their feet, and they winced and ducked at the implosion of air in their eardrums as passing shot whipped about their heads. Magically, the bushmen had disappeared, like little brown leprechauns at the first shot. Santaine knew they would not see them again. Already, they were on their way back to join their clan at Ochi Pan. Blaine pushed up the rear sight of the Lienfield to 400 yards and aimed for the crest of the kopje, where a feather of drifting blue gun smoke betrayed the hidden gunman. He fired as fast as he could work the bolt, spraying bullets to cover the fleeing troopers, watching white chips of granite burst from the skyline of the kopje as the raking fire withered away. He snatched a clip of ammunition from his bandolier and pressed the brass cartridges into the open breech of the hot rifle, slammed the bolt shut and flung the weapon to his shoulder, and poured fire up at the marksmen on the crest of the kopje. One by one, Hansmeier and his troopers reached the ravine and tumbled into it, sweating and panting wildly. With grim satisfaction, Blaine noticed that each of them had carried his rifle with him, and they wore their bandoliers strapped across their chests, 75 rounds a man. "They shot the horses in the head, but never touched a man." Hansmeier's breathing whistled in his throat as he struggled with the words. "They never fired a shot near me," Santaine blurted. Lothar must have taken great care not to endanger her. She realized with a tremor just how easily he could have put a bullet into the back of her skull as she fled. Blaine was reloading the Lienfield, but he looked up and smiled humorlessly. "The fellow is no idiot. He knows that he has shot his bolt, and he is not looking to add murder to the long list of the charges against him." He looked at Hansmeier. "How many men on the kopje?" he demanded. "I don't know," Hansmeier answered, "but there is more than one. The rate of fire was too much for one man, and I heard shots overlapping." "All right. Let's find out how many there are." Blaine beckoned Santaine and Hansmeier up beside him and explained. Santaine took his binoculars and moved down the ravine until she was well out on the flank and below a dense tuft of grass which grew on the lip of the ravine. She used the tuft as a screen and raised her head until she could make out the summit of the kopje. She focused the binoculars and called, "Ready!" Blaine had his helmet on the ramrod of his rifle, and he lifted it, and Hansmeier fired two shots into the air to draw the attention of the marksman on the kopje. Almost immediately, the answering fusillade crackled from the hilltop. More than one shot fired simultaneously, and dust kicked off the lip of the ravine inches from the khaki helmet, while ricochet howled away over the mapani trees. "Two or three," Hansmeier called. "Three," Santaine confirmed, lowering the binoculars as she ducked down. "I saw three heads." "Good," Blaine nodded. "We've got them then. Just a matter of time." "Blaine," Santaine loosened the strap of her water bottle from the saddle. "That's all we have got." She shook the bottle, and it was less than a quarter full. They all stared at it, and involuntarily Blaine licked his lips. "We will be able to recover the other bottles just as soon as it's dark," he assured them, and then briskly, "Sergeant, take two troopers with you. Try and work your way around the other side of the kopje. Make sure nobody leaves by the back door." Lothar de la Rey sat propped against one of the huge round granite boulders at the top of the kopje. He sat in the shade with the Mauser across his lap. He was bareheaded, and his long golden hair blew softly across his forehead. He stared out towards the south, across the plain and the scattered Mopani forest, in the direction from which the relentless pursuit would come. The climb up the sheer granite wall had taxed him severely, and he was not yet recovered from it. "Leave me one water bottle," he ordered, and Hendrik placed it beside him. "I have filled it from those," Hendrik indicated the pile of discarded empty water bottles, "and we have a full bottle to see us as far as the river."
"Good."
Lothar nodded and checked the other equipment that was laid out beside him on the granite slab. There were four hand grenades, the old potato masher type with a wooden handle. They had lain in the cache with the horse irons and other equipment for almost 20 years, and he could not rely upon them. Kleinboy had left his rifle and his bandolier of Mauser ammunition with the grenades. So Lothar had two rifles and 150 rounds. More than enough, if the grenades worked. If they didn't, it wouldn't matter anyway.
"All right," Lothar said quietly. "I have everything I need. You can go."
Hendrik turned his cannonball of a head to peer into the south. They were on a grandstand, high above the world, and the sweep of their horizon was 20 miles or more. But there was, as yet, no sign of the pursuit. Hendrik started to rise to his feet and then paused. He squinted into the heat haze and the glare.
"Dust," he said.
It was still 5 miles away, a pale haze above the trees.
"Yes."
Lothar had seen it minutes before. "It could be a herd of zebra or a willy-nilly. But I wouldn't bet my share of the loot on it. Move out, now." Hendrik did not obey immediately. He stared into the white man's sapphire-yellow eyes. Hendrik had not argued nor protested when Lothar had explained what they must do. It was right. It was logical. They had always left their wounded, often with just a pistol at hand, for when the pain or the hyenas closed in. And yet, this time, Hendrik felt the need to say something, but there were no words that could match the enormity of the moment. He knew he was leaving a part of his own life upon this sun-blasted rock.
"I will look after the boy," he said simply, and Lothar nodded. "I want to talk to Manny."
He licked his dry, cracked lips and shivered briefly with the heat of the poison in his blood.
"Wait for him at the bottom. It will take only a minute."
"Come." Hendrik jerked his head and Kleinboy stood up beside him. Together, they moved with the swiftness of hunting panthers to the cliff, and Kleinboy slipped over the edge. Hendrik paused and looked back. He raised his right hand.
"Stay in peace," he said simply.
"Go in peace, old friend," Lothar murmured.
He had never called him friend before, and Hendrik flinched at the word. Then he turned his head so Lothar could not see his eyes, and a moment later he was gone. Lothar stared after him for long seconds and then shook himself lightly, driving back the self-pity and the sickly sentiment and the fever mists which threatened to close in and unman him completely.
"Manfred," he said, and the boy started.
He had been sitting as close as he dared to his father, watching his face, hanging on every word, every gesture he made.
"Pa," he whispered, "I don't want to go. I don't want to leave you. I don't want to be without you."
Lothar made an impatient gesture, hardening his features to hide this softness in him.
"You will do as I tell you."
"Pa, you have never let me down before, Manny. I have been proud of you. Don't spoil it for me now. Don't let me find out that my son is a coward."
"I'm not a coward."
"Then you will do what you have to do," he said harshly.
And before Manfred could protest again, he ordered,
"Bring me the haversack."
Lothar placed the bag between his feet and with his good hand unbuckled the flap. He took one of the packages from it and tore open the heavy brown paper with his teeth. He spilled the stones into a small pile on the granite beside him and then spread them. He picked out 10 of the biggest and whitest gems.
"Take off your jacket," he ordered,
and when Manfred handed the garment to him, Lothar pierced a tiny hole in the lining with his clasp knife.
"These stones will be worth thousands of pounds, enough to see you full-grown and educated," he said, as he stuffed them one at a time into the lining of the jacket with his forefinger. "But these others, there are too many, too heavy, too bulky to hide. Dangerous for you to carry them with you. A death warrant."
He pushed himself to his feet with an effort.
"Come."
He led Manfred amongst the cluster of huge boulders, bracing himself against the rock to keep himself from falling, while Manfred supported him from the other side.
"Here."
He grunted and lowered himself to his knees, Manfred squatting down beside him. At their feet, the granite cap was cracked through as though split with a chisel. At the top, the crack was only as wide as 2 handspans, but it was deep. They could not see the bottom of it, though they peered down 30 feet or more. The crack narrowed gradually as it descended, and the depths of it were lost in shadow. Lothar dangled the haversack of diamonds over the aperture.
"Mark this place well," he whispered. "Look back often when you go northwards, so that you will remember this hill. The stones will be waiting for you when you need them."
Lothar opened his fingers, and the haversack dropped into the crack. They heard the canvas scraping against the sides of the granite cleft as it fell, and then silence, as it jammed deep down in the narrow throat of the crack. Side by side they peered down, and they could just make out the lighter colour and the contrasting texture of the canvas 30 feet down. But it would escape even the concentrated scrutiny of anyone who did not know exactly where to look for it.
"That is my legacy to you, Manny," Lothar whispered and crawled back from the aperture. "All right. Hendrik is waiting for you. It is time for you to go. Go quickly, now."
He wanted to embrace his son for the last time, to kiss his eyes and his lips and press him to his heart, but he knew it would undo them both. If they clung to each other now, they could never bring themselves to part.
"Go,"
he ordered, and Manfred sobbed and flung himself at his father.
"I want to stay with you," he cried.
Lothar caught his wrist and held him at arm's length.
"Do you want me to be ashamed?" he snarled. "Is that how you want me to remember you, snivelling like a girl?"
"Pa, don't send me away. Please, let me stay."
Lothar drew back, released his grip on Manfred's wrist, and immediately whipped his open palm across his face and then swung back with his knuckles. The double slap knocked Manfred onto his haunches, leaving livid red blotches on his pale cheeks, and a tiny serpent of bright blood crawled from his nostril down over his upper lip. He stared at Lothar with shocked and incredulous eyes.
"Get out of here!"
Lothar hissed at him, summoning all his courage and resolve to make his voice scornful and his expression savage.
"I won't have a blubbering little ninny hanging around my neck. Get out of here before I take the strap to you."
Manfred scrambled to his feet and backed away, still staring with horrified disbelief at his father.
"Go on! Get away!"
Lothar's expression never wavered, and his voice was angry and disdainful and unrelenting.
"Get out of here!"
Manfred turned and stumbled to the edge of the cliff. There he turned once more and held out his hands.
"Pa, please don't..."
"Go, damn you, go!"
The boy scrambled over the edge, and the sounds of his clumsy descent dwindled into silence. Only then Lothar let his shoulders droop, and he sobbed once. Then suddenly he was weeping silently, his whole body shaking.
"It's the fever," he told himself. "The fever has weakened me."
But the image of his son's face, golden and beautiful, and destroyed with grief, still filled his mind, and he felt something tearing in his chest, an unbearable physical pain.
"Forgive me, my son," he whispered through his tears.
"There was no other way to save you. Forgive me, I beg you."